if you go? Where shall I go? What shall I do?
Frankly, my dear, I don't give a damn.
After the film adaptation of Gone with the Wind was released 70 years ago, it grossed enough revenue, even during the Great Depression, to become the biggest blockbuster ever. But despite its popularity, it has been criticized over the years for being misogynistic, racist, and not a particularly successful work of art. Film critic and historian Molly Haskell joins us now to talk about her fresh perspective on the subject, called Frankly, My Dear, Gone with the Wind Revisited, which is published by Yale University Press, and it's always a pleasure to see you, Molly. Welcome back to our show.
Thank you, for me too.
Do you feel Gone with the Wind has been given a bad rap over the past 70 years?
Well, you can't call a film that successful, given unjustified, you know, it's not unjustified, but I think it's had a bad critical reputation because it's bloated, it's for all sorts of reasons. It's a film done by many hands rather than one, and of course we're now all auteurists after a fashion. We believe that a single director, and I think generally it is true, that a single director gives its imprint and creates a work of art, whereas this is too many, it shouldn't have worked. There were too many cooks that should have been spoiled, and yet somehow it does.
And you would have assumed that it would have worked best with the first director, George Cukor.
Well, you would.
But then he was dumped from the project.
He was. There are three or four scenes in there that he directed which are beautiful. The opening scene, the scene where Mammy is lacing up Scarlett in the corset, and two others. But he was very meticulous. He was a woman's director. He'd worked with Selznick before on Little Women and movies like that. And his pace was, well, nobody knows exactly why he was fired, but you suspect that it's because his pace was too slow. He wasn't a director of epics.
It's also rumored that Clark Gable felt uncomfortable because he was gay.
Yeah.
Now, is this a women's film?
Well, no, I think it's actually a crossover film. That's what's exciting. It somehow transcends the chick flick or the then chick flick genre. It is, I mean, this is why I think misogynist is certainly the wrong term for it, because it's definitely a matriarchy. These are strong women, and the men, if anything, and it's racist in the sense that movies were racist at that time, and that's something we can maybe talk about a little later. But it's just a matriarchy. You know, Scarlett and Mammy are the strongest characters in it.
Well, you mentioned the lacing up scene, and there have been people who have objected to that as being misogynistic, which, of course, is silly because it was just the way things were in those days.
Well, it was. And the strongest characters, I think Mammy is, Scarlett, of course, and Ellen O'Hara. I mean, you can see all the men in it. And if anybody has a kind of argument for a defamation suit, it would be the white males in the movie. You know?
Should we make a distinction between the attitudes depicted in Margaret Mitchell's novel and the movie version?
Well, I think the movie is superior to the book in some ways. It streamlines it. It cuts out a lot of repetition. It also leaves out some interesting characters. For instance, there's a woman, the Tarleton twins, who are kind of fops. Their mother is a horsewoman, a very powerful, interesting woman, not at all of the Bell type, though an aristocrat, and she's a big horse breeder and believes in eugenics. I mean, she doesn't think Melanie and Ashley should get married because they're too much alike. They should have fresh blood in that family. So she's an interesting woman. Some of the blacks that don't get in are interesting. For instance, Prissy's mother, Dilsey, is a fascinating, beautiful, half-Indian black woman, and sort of aristocratic in the way that Ellen O'Hara is aristocratic and Scarlett isn't quite. So Scarlett and Prissy are kind of analogous in their own way.
You mentioned that it reflected the racial attitudes of the time. Should we see the film through the prism of public attitudes in 1939?
Well, I think what we have to do, I think that it goes through, this is what's interesting about the film, it looks different at different times. And when we saw it in the 70s, at a time of maximum sensitivity to racial issues and activism and militant sort of feelings, we almost couldn't watch it. It was cringe-inducing, as were all movies that time where blacks were servants. Yet now I think the tensions have relaxed a bit. There has been progress made. We can look at it in a different light, which is so freeing. I think it's wonderful that we can have a sort of different atmosphere and a different conversation now.
But the film does portray Reconstruction in a very negative light. And hadn't filmmakers been sensitized at all by the negative reactions to the depictions of Reconstruction and D.W. Griffith's Birth of a Nation, which actually led to some degree to the creation of the NAACP?
Well, it did. Well, of course, Griffith's film led to the resurgence of the Ku Klux Klan. But you know, it's hard to believe, but this view of Reconstruction that both Griffith and Margaret Mitchell had was current until fairly recently. I mean, it was really, you know, revisionists like Eric Foner who showed the light in the light that blacks there was a period of about 20 years right after the war, just short of 20 years, where blacks had position in state legislatures and jobs and progress was being made, and suddenly there was a huge white Southern reaction against it. And this is that view of brief progress was never shown until recently. So she was just very much of her time in what she reflects.
Also in portraying a kind of noble Southern culture that is destroyed by the Civil War.
Well, this is what's fascinating. I think some aspects of the film fade and others rise to the surface. And the Depression angle, this is what everyone at the time said. In 1939, they were still at the sort of tail end of the Depression. And on the cards that the preview audiences filled out, they all wrote about it as a Depression fable. And it was really, because the South was, didn't call it the Depression, but it was a devastation after the war. And then Margaret Mitchell was writing first in the 20s, and the sort of pre-war spirit of affluence and indulgence and luxury suddenly followed by a crash. And now we're living through the same thing again.
So the South shall rise again.
Well, maybe Gone with the Wind will rise again anyway.
But also the country shall rise again because we've been down and now we're going to
go
up again.
This is what we find the source of that dream.
Do you think that your experience growing up in the South gives you certain insights into the dynamics of the story that a Brooklyn-born moviegoer like me might not have?
Well, a Brooklyn-born boy moviegoer like you. Well, it's
because I did see it when I was a kid.
Did you?
So I've seen it five or six times over my life.
Well, I think men have, and for different reasons. I mean, one thing that's interesting, why it's not, strictly speaking, a woman's film, is the war. And though you don't have actual battle scenes, the feeling of the war is palpable. I mean, that shot of the Southerners wounded and dead is more, you know, excruciating than any battle scene. So yes, I think people come into it at different angles. Certainly in the South, it was the book was holy scripture. I mean, you couldn't avoid it. But I found that my Northern friends maybe didn't respond to it in quite as intensely. But it was sort of sexier than Marjorie Morningstar and Nancy Drew. There was something there, the glamour, the South. I think the plantation myth was something that people were fascinated by then, and maybe not so much now, which is not a bad thing.
My guest is Molly Haskell, who has written a book called Frankly, My Dear, Gone with the Wind Revisited. It is published by Yale University Press. Would you have written this when you were writing film criticism on a daily basis?
I never would have. I think I never would have done it if Yale University Press hadn't come to me to do this as one of their American Icon series. I wouldn't have touched it with a 10-foot pole. But I think
because it is so controversial.
It's so vexed. The race issues in it, the South, and because I'm from the South. But this is why it suddenly opened up to me as just an enormous opportunity, because I had left the South. I'd fled the South largely because of sort of racial tensions and the conservatism and all of that, and yet I loved it, and it gave me a chance to go back and read a lot of Civil War literature and look at earlier films and think about all these issues, and because I realized we had come to a time where it was easy to talk about. Black scholars and scholars of black cinema have written very nuanced appreciations of Hattie McDaniel and Butterfly McQueen in the movie, so suddenly it had opened up, and then the Depression angle came in, which was completely unexpected. So it is one of these movies that reverberates on different levels.
Well, there's also the feminist angle. I don't know whether there's been any kind of reconciliation.
Well, you mean about the sort of famous rape scene Well,
and any number of other things, you know, women, you can either see the women here as being strong or complicated characters, which is good, or you can see them as being victims of men.
Well, I think you see a society in which women have very little choice, where it's either marriage a la Melanie, and she's a very strong woman, but it's completely masked by this deference to the male sex. But Scarlett is completely fiercely independent. She pokes holes and challenges the whole notion of male supremacy, the Southern myth, all the pieties of the South.
But she's a pain in the butt.
Well, she's terrible.
She's an adolescent who never grows up.
She is that and a dozen other things. I mean, there is a kind of playfulness in Margaret Mitchell, or certainly having it many different ways with Scarlett, but I think she does pay the consequences, too. I mean, she is independent-minded. She does run roughshod over people. but then she suffers loss and anguish. What the great thing she doesn't do, which all other, I challenge you to find any other movie heroine, including Betty Davis, she doesn't pay in the form of this kind of retribution whereby you suddenly do penance and are transformed. There's none of that sanctimoniousness. And that's what's exhilarating. I think it's one of the reasons that she endures.
What about Vivien Leigh's performance as Scarlett? How important was it in the way we've come to understand the character?
I think deeply so. First of all, it had to be...
Can you read the book anymore without seeing
Vivien
Leigh?
No, impossible. But that's all right. I don't think Margaret Mitchell's book is one of those ones where the characterizations are sacred in some literary way. I think it was sort of meant to be made into a movie, and fortunately it got the absolute perfect cast.
And Clark Gable was in her mind, she said, when she was writing
Then the funny thing is, then she said to David Selznick, we don't like him. She suddenly changed. You know, she had been this sort of rebel Scarlet and read porn, and there's a lot of sort of semi-porn writing in the book. And then suddenly she becomes this very... pristine ladylike person, and she writes to Selznick, we don't like Clark Gable. She suddenly had other ideas for Rhett, namely Basil Rathbone and Ronald Coleman and Frederick March. I mean, it was like an about face. All the stuff she'd written about these sort of lurid, lusty Rhett, you couldn't imagine, because she suddenly was disavowing that side of herself, that sort of racy, unacceptable side of herself. So Vivien Leigh, and I think it had to be Clark Gable, and it had to be, I think, the fact that he could never master the Southern accent worked in his favor, because it wasn't one more sort of Anglo-Southern character. There was something cosmopolitan and not quite Southern about him. And Vivien Leigh was this strange new creature, which it also had to be. I think most Hollywood actresses would have either brought too much baggage if they were stars. Selznick didn't want it to be a Katharine Hepburn movie or a Betty Davis movie. Or they would have toned down, I think. So they would have inevitably softened that character and asked for more sympathy than Vivien Leigh ever asked for.
The story is that 1,400 women were considered for the role, but that's really not the case.
Well, people were throwing themselves at Selznick, at Margaret Mitchell. I mean, it was just an absolute zoo. There were people writing satires about it. Claire Booth Luce wrote one even while it was happening. Everyone wanted that role. And the star actresses, the A-list, would not audition for it because they didn't want to be humiliated by being turned down, but all sorts of other ones did. And I think Selznick really just enjoyed having this parade of actresses coming through his studio.
And as you say, he wound up with the perfect cast,
the
didn't
perfect
he?
Cast. Flawless.
Did Mitchell have any real input?
Well, she did not. She didn't want to be involved. She was terrified by this time, as she'd become this completely conventional society lady. She didn't want to be embarrassed before her friends in Atlanta, and she trusted Selznick. At the same time, she was sure it would be a vulgarization, and in many ways it was. I mean, Tara, which was this really a farmhouse, becomes this lavish plantation that looked like Selznick International. So she didn't. She completely cut herself off. She refused all of his pleas to consult. He wrote her that he didn't. You know, he was sort of a fetishist about the women's clothing. And he wrote up, how should they tie Mammy's bandana? And she said, I'm not going to get into a twit over a head rag. She just wouldn't even answer him. But she had a kind of mole on the set, a woman named Susan Myrick. She had suggested, she'd proposed that she come and sort of vet the accents and that sort of thing. And so Susan kept her informed, because she really was dying to know what was going on. She just wanted to have deniability so that she wasn't associated with it if it was a complete disaster.
I asked you earlier about Vivien Leigh's portrayal. Do you think her personal problems, which really came to light later in her life, color her performance at all?
Yeah, well, she was madly in love with Laurence Olivier, of course, at the time, and their affair was just at its height, or almost. And she wanted to be with him, and Selznick wouldn't let her get away. She also developed, there were symptoms of what would later become tuberculosis, manic depression. She really was a very unstable person, as it turned out. But at this point, she's still pretty much in control, but she gets more free. She's working overtime. They're doing location shooting. She wants to get back to Larry Olivier. And so all of this comes into it, that she wanted the part. She campaigned for the part. It wasn't one of these things where she was plucked by David Selznick. She actually paid her way to America to try to engineer a meeting so that she knew she was right for it. So she can see something manic, and there's something manic and obsessed in her performance, and I think that's just what makes it.
Well, she may have been unhappy during some of the shoot, but this is the role that made her into one of the biggest stars. If she could have cashed in more, she would have been one of the giants of
movies. It would, and the whole reason was Laurence Olivier. He was so important to her, and his opinion and his stage career, so she had to be his equal. So it became the stage over. I mean, in a sense, this gave her some leverage with Selznick, because she was a theater snob. She was so much more interested in that than in doing movies. And Olivier, I think, was jealous of her, because he knew that she had it in movies in a way that he never would. So her Hollywood career was really sacrificed on the altar of her love for him and her desire to acquire prestige in the theater.
Do we have any record of what he felt about the film?
Well, no, we don't. He was, according to David Thompson, his biography of Selznick, he tried to steer her away from parts that would have been good for her, as he did to his other wives. So presumably he was very ambivalent, though he did accompany her to the premiere, and he managed to get a smile on his face. So I guess he put a good face on it.
You mentioned that the novel has softcore porn for the time anyway. It's pretty racy. The film ends on a very racy note. The line that you've taken for your title must have been considered rather sexy at the time, a time when there was heavy film censorship. Did the film face any problems?
Well, somehow there was a lot of wrangling back and forth with the Hays office, but they would sort of give and take. There was a sort of horse trading that was going on, and Selznick would give in on something else knowing that he would get this. And that was another thing about him. He was just obsessional about that kind of detail, and it makes it. And also, he was the one that added the word frankly, because in the book it just says, "My dear, I don't give a damn," and the rhythm is completely wrong somehow, and the frankly just enhances it. And you had the recording of it, and Gable is very good in that. He doesn't overdo it.
Right.
And it's a beautiful line.
He could have really hit that line hard, but instead
he
says it's like a toss-off.
Almost a throwaway, yeah. Yeah, and that's not quite the end, of course, but some people think that should have been the end. I don't think so. But.
Now, Margaret Mitchell didn't want to publish this book at first. What changed her mind?
Well, it took her so long, and she was, on the one hand, she had had a career as a newspaper reporter. She really loved working, and yet it wasn't really quite a ladylike thing to do, so she was squirreling this manuscript away. She was terrified of lawsuits. Her family, her father and brother were copyright lawyers, intellectual property rights, so she was terrified of lawsuits. So she couldn't let it go, and also I think something in her sensed that the life would never be the same. I think she knew she had something big on her hands.
Would you call her a feminist, pre-feminist?
Well, her mother was a huge suffragette. Her mother was an activist. This was one of the things she was reacting against. Her mother wanted only to read the best literature. Her mother was a marcher, a speechmaker. Margaret was none of those things. She hated academic life. And she said that her mother wouldn't have let her read this book until she was 18 years old.
Molly Haskell is a writer and film critic who's lectured widely on the role of women in film, the author of From Reverence to Rape, The Treatment of Women in the Movies. She will be talking with Turner Classic Movies host Robert Osborne tonight at 7 o'clock at the Barnes & Noble store on 82nd Street and Broadway about her new book, which is called Frankly, My Dear, Gone with the Wind Revisited, published by Yale University Press. And Molly, it's always a pleasure to see you. It's been a lot of fun talking about
this. You too, Leonard. Thanks a lot.